Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. France says the man who organized the attack on Paris is dead. French prosecutors confirm that the suspected leader of last week's Paris attacks was among those killed in a police raid Wednesday. The Paris prosecutor's office said the bullet-riddled body of Abdelhamid Abaoud, a Belgian national of Moroccan descent, was found inside an apartment targeted in the seven-hour police raid in Saint-Denis, a northern suburb of Paris. Abaoud, who was 27 or 28 years old, was identified from fingerprints. At least eight people were arrested in the raid, during which a woman identified as Abaoud's cousin died when her explosives-filled vest exploded. Three police officers were wounded. A police dog was killed. VOA's Daniel Scharf in Paris said the announcement came as a relief to police.
This was very important, not just to be able to show that they could take down the leader of these this terrorist group that had perpetrated these horrible attacks in Paris, but also to show that French intelligence can be effective. After the second major terrorist attack to take place in Paris in less than a year, there's quite a bit of criticism and pressure on French authorities, especially after the second set of attacks in Paris, that not enough was being done, that they weren't getting enough information to prevent these kind of things. So getting this guy and getting him quickly was very important, and the French authorities are to be commended for that.
VOA's Daniel Scharf in Paris. French lawmakers voted Thursday to extend the state of emergency declared after Friday's attacks by 3 months. This is VOA News. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio said his city will not be intimidated or live in fear after the Islamic State group released a new video Wednesday evening threatening the largest city in the United States. De Blasio said, "We understand it is the goal of terrorists to intimidate and disrupt democratic society, but de Blasio said we will not submit to their wishes." He spoke from Times Square, a popular tourist spot that appears in the video. The images show what appears to be an explosive device that is then zipped inside someone's leather jacket, followed by shots of Times Square. China is condemning the Islamic State group's execution of a Chinese citizen and pledging to bring those who carried out the act to justice. However, analysts say the tragic death of Fan Jinhui, the first known Chinese captive to be killed by the group, will not change Beijing's overall approach to the ongoing conflict in Syria. More on that from VOA's Beijing correspondent Bill Ide.
China's position in the Syria conflict has been one of advocating a political solution to the problem. It has rejected the use of violence. China has a foreign policy of non-interference that it largely uses in most of its dealings with other countries and other conflicts and situations like that. So really, the question is how or what will come next.
The Islamic State this week claimed it killed Fan, a former advertising executive and freelance consultant, as well as a Norwegian captive, but gave no details about when or how they were killed. While the world's attention is on Paris in the wake of Friday night's deadly attacks, terrorism from various sides remains a looming threat in many African countries. Nigerian cities have been targeted this week by attacks many believe were staged by the violent Islamist group Boko Haram. More from Zlata Chahok.
Combating violence in Africa was the focus of Wednesday's meeting between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Angolan counterpart Georges Chicoté.
Angola plays a very special role. It has a senior leadership stature that has been very important to helping to find peaceful resolution to some of these conflicts.
Since April, tensions have been brewing in Burundi, where President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for a third term, contrary to the country's constitution. The ruling party militias are striking terror among civilians linked to the opposition, with many fleeing to neighboring Tanzania and Uganda. Angola's foreign minister said terrorism is as big a threat in Africa as it is in Europe. Zlatica Hope, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, the Paris prosecutor put out a statement earlier today saying that they had been able to identify him through skin samples that were found at the scene of yesterday's early morning raid in Saint-Denis, a northern suburb of Paris.
That's Daniel Scharf reporting from Paris that authorities have identified the remains of the alleged mastermind of last Friday's terrorist attacks. Details next.
Also, two female suicide bombers killed more than 14 people in a mobile phone market in Kano in northeastern Nigeria yesterday. At least 100 others were wounded in the blasts.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Paris prosecutor's office today confirmed the death of the alleged mastermind of last Friday's terrorist attacks. Abdelhamad Abaoud has been identified as one of two people killed in a police raid yesterday on an apartment in a Paris suburb. Abaoud is a Belgian. He was killed in a seven-hour shootout. The other body found in the apartment was that of a woman who died reportedly when she detonated a suicide vest. The French news agency says her body was also riddled with bullets. VOA's Daniel Scharf is in Paris. He spoke to Joe DiCapua about how French authorities were able to positively identify Abaoud.
Well, the Paris prosecutor put out a statement earlier today saying that they had been able to identify him through skin samples that were found at the scene of yesterday's early morning raid in Saint-Denis, a northern suburb of Paris. They examined these samples. They were able to confirm that it was the man they believe is the mastermind behind the terrorist attacks in Paris on Friday.
Now, they identified this man nearly a week after the attacks. How important was it for French authorities to get their man?
This was very important, not just to be able to show that they could take down the leader of this terrorist group that had perpetrated these horrible attacks in Paris, but also to show that French intelligence can be effective. After the second major terrorist attack to take place in Paris in less than a year, there's quite a bit of criticism and pressure on French authorities, especially after the second set of attacks in Paris, that not enough was being done, that they weren't getting enough information to prevent these kind of things. So getting this guy and getting him quickly was very important, and the French authorities are to be commended for that.
Is there still concern that more people may still be at large who might have been involved in the attack?
There is, and there still is, a manhunt going on. There's cooperation with the Belgian authorities who have been launching their own raids. We have to keep in mind that just in the last few days, there have been hundreds of raids taking place throughout France and also in Belgium in connection with the terrorist attacks on Friday. There have been dozens of arrests. Dozens of weapons have also been seized. So this is very much an ongoing investigation and an ongoing hunt to find out exactly how many people were involved, not only in Friday's attacks, but also in these sleeper cells, which they believe were waiting to launch further attacks. The group that was taken down, including the mastermind yesterday in Saint-Denis, was believed to be plotting a second attack in the Paris area. That's according to information that's leaked out and been reported by the Reuters news agency. So certainly they want to try and get as many of these plotters as soon as they can and show that they can secure the area and that they can protect French people, especially after such horrific attacks.
Daniel, I know you've been traveling in and around Paris. Can you tell us what the mood of the city is like nearly a week after the attacks?
Well, it's still quite somber. People were very shaken up, of course, because of these attacks, not only on the concert hall and the French National Stadium, but also on, you know, a number of cafes and bistros in Paris. This is French culture. This is French life. And it really felt, I think, to everyone like this was an attack on French culture, on French life, on Parisian lifestyle, something that was very important and symbolic to people in France and in Paris. It was very difficult, and it's still difficult for them to move on with life. But you can see a lot of strength in the people of Paris, and cafe life is returning somewhat to normality. People are going out again. But you also see a lot of memorials set up all around the areas where these attacks occurred. There are people laying flowers constantly, large crowds of people stopping by to pay their respects and light candles, leave messages of support and patriotism. You know, so there's certainly a great deal of pain that the country is still going through. But at the same time, there is a great sense of unity and strength that is observable in Paris following these terrible attacks.
That's VOA's Daniel Scharf from Paris. He spoke to Joe DiCapua.
Four governments in the Balkans have shut their borders against migrants and refugees. Today's action leaves thousands of people in Europe stranded at border crossings. The overnight decision was the backlash that both asylum seekers and European nations had feared would happen after the deadly Paris attacks. Balkan countries have been filtering the flow of migrants to Europe, granting passage of those fleeing conflict in the Middle East and Afghanistan. UN officials say they were turning back others from Africa and Asia. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Europe needs to move faster with hotspots in Greece, where refugees and other migrants can be registered. Ms. Merkel said they should be fairly distributed around Europe or sent directly back home if their case for asylum does not meet the criteria. Germany has registered more than 758,000 through October.
Two female suicide bombers killed more than 14 people in a mobile phone market in Kano in northeastern Nigeria yesterday. At least 100 others were wounded in the blasts. Kano is the heart of the region where Boko Haram militants have waged an insurgency for 6 years. Boko Haram is believed to have killed more than 1,000 people since President Muhammadu Buhari took office in May. Local news reports indicate that Nigerian Special Forces units have killed about 40 Boko Haram terrorists and destroyed a rebel facility used for making rockets. Army spokesman Sani Usman has told Nigerian news reporters that troops have also arrested two terrorist leaders. One was captured on the streets of Maiduguri in Borno State. In Chad, the national parliament has extended a state of emergency in the Lake Chad region for another 4 months due to Boko Haram violence. Boko Haram fighters killed 14 people in a village near the lake earlier this week.
There is good news today about a clinical trial for a new Ebola vaccine. The vaccine, known as CHAD-3-EBOZ, was well tolerated and triggered a strong immune response. Adults in Mali and the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore took part in the trial. The study included the first testing of this vaccine in adult healthcare workers and other at-risk persons in Africa. The findings appear in the journal Lancet Infectious Disease. Larger trials of the vaccine, sponsored by GSK Biologicals, have already begun. In other Ebola-related news, communities in Liberia have been searching for ways to commemorate more than 4,800 people who died during the regional Ebola epidemic. Prince Collins reports for VOA from Monrovia, where families have begun planting remembrance trees outside their houses.
I plenty of people the way their loved one, their friends, their relatives were buried.
A local radio campaign is encouraging Monrovia residents to plant kola nut trees and palm trees in their backyards to remember relatives who died during the Ebola epidemic. Orita Morris said a silent prayer as she planted a small palm tree for her father. Tears streamed down her face.
I don't had the time to bury him, to give him proper burial, and they took him away. That's the reason we're planting the tree in remembrance of him. When I see the tree, I will always remember him. I will always think about him, how loving, how caring my father was.
The corpses of Ebola victims are especially contagious. To contain the virus, Ebola victims and people who died of unknown causes in Liberia were ordered quickly incinerated or buried by specially trained strangers, sometimes in unmarked graves. Michael Spear was head of the Ebola burial teams in nearby Maigibi County. He says they did what they had to do to stop the virus. Now he hopes the trees fill a void.
It fills in the vacuum, and it helps you that as that tree grows, your departed loved one or friend or relative grows into a new life.
The Search for Common Ground Peace Building Initiative is working with communities throughout Liberia recovering from Ebola. Acting Country Director Aaron Weir says each community is finding its own way to honor the dead.
In Cape Mount, where the Islamic practice, which is pretty much dominant in that part of the counties, chose to do a feast and to read special Quran and scriptures from the Quran in their way of remembering those who died. In another community, they built a monument. In Lofa County, they are putting together a symbolic grave.
Liberia discharged its last Ebola patient on July 20. The World Health Organization declared the country Ebola-free September 3rd. Prince Collins for VOA News, Monrovia.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Paris prosecutor's office today confirmed the death of the alleged mastermind of last Friday's terrorist attack in Paris. And two female suicide bombers killed more than 14 people in a mobile phone market in Kano in northeastern Nigeria yesterday. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
An ambitious new initiative to end global hunger by 2025 was launched today by the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, in Washington, D.C. Compact 2025 seeks to mobilize the world community to end hunger by working with countries, UN agencies, civil society, and the private sector. They plan to replicate strategies that are working in other countries that are falling short in meeting the challenges of food insecurity. IFPRI Director General Shengen Fan says the compact is a critical first step to eradicating poverty by 2030, the date for achieving the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. I spoke with Fan about the strategies to end hunger worldwide.
Well, the aim of Compact 2025 is to end hunger and undernutrition by 2025 through research, knowledge, data, and capacity support. And more importantly, we are supporting countries to move the global agenda to country implementation.
How are you going to get countries as well as the international community to work together on this?
Well, I think we have already created some momentum for the last 4 or 5 years to really place hunger, malnutrition very high in the global agenda and the national agenda. Now, the question is, how can we really support them? How can we really accelerate the progress by promoting mutual learning, sharing the good practices, and providing innovative methods or innovative policies, technologies to bring all stakeholders together? And I firmly believe that we can accelerate that progress we have already achieved and to end hunger and undernutrition by 2025.
What do countries, for example, in Africa and even other developing countries need to do for themselves to end hunger and poverty in their own countries?
Well, firstly, political will is so crucial, so critical. The political leaders from the African countries must commit themselves to lead that process to end hunger and undernutrition. I'm so glad that that's the political will is already there, let's say, from Ethiopia, Rwanda, Malawi, and beyond. So many countries, the national leaders, have committed themselves to do that. So the political will is number one. Number two is to bring knowledge, information, data, and good practices together to learn from each other, to really see what will be the best strategies, best policies, best technologies to tackle this issue. For example, some countries use so-called smallholder net agricultural strategies to promote agriculture growth that can benefit so many hungry, poor people in rural areas. Other countries also use so-called productive social safety net to link short-term relief to help the poor, hungry people to long-term development. And other countries also use empowering women. The woman plays a critical role in linking agriculture, linking social protection, linking development program to nutrition health outcome. And again, many other countries, or probably not just many other countries, many countries also begin to invest in improving sanitation, to improve the health care of general citizens, particularly women and children. So if we can bring all these different policies, different stakeholders together with the strong political will, and I'm very confident that we will be able to end hunger and nutrition by 2025.
And this then is what you do envision. Do you actually see this happening by 2025?
Well, I think it will not happen automatically. We must work together. We must accelerate the progress. We must use the innovative methods, tools, policies, institutional arrangements. If we commit ourselves to ensure mutual accountability, to use the best data, best evidence, best practices, we will be able to do it.
The whole big picture is to eradicate poverty by 2030. And your Compact 2025, you say, is a critical first step to eradicating poverty. So what would be the second step then?
This is absolutely right, because if we aim to end extreme poverty, and we must end hunger and undernutrition before that, how can you end extreme poverty when the people are still hungry, undernourished? So that's the logic. We must end hunger and undernutrition first.
Shengen Fan is Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, in Washington, D.C.
South Sudan's parliament today amended the transitional constitution to give President Salva Kiir the power to appoint new state assembly lawmakers and governors. The move would pave the way for splitting the country into 28 states from 10. Minority lawmakers with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement for Democratic Change walked out of the session. Waki Simon Wudu has more from Juba.
Before the vote was called to change the constitution, an argument erupted between the leader of the minority SPLM-DC and the speaker, who is backed by the ruling SPLM party members.
First of all, the order is in proper order. But my procedure is in order, because
it is not in order. Please,
the attendance here is less than two-thirds.
Minority leader Onyoti Adigo Nyekwech argues with Speaker Manasseh Magok Rundiel over a point of procedure, questioning whether a quorum was present to hold the vote on amending the constitution. Minutes later, minority MPs walked out. Despite the disagreement, the vote was held and the amendment passed. Speaker Rundiel:
I thank you very much for passing this. Although our opponents, your opponents may be lying, and they see the number. The number will not actually be created by us. In itself, those people who will cheat, they will be satisfied. So we have passed this with the two-thirds NLA and two-thirds unanimously.
Under Article 162 of the Constitution, President Kiir will have the power to divide the territory of the Republic of South Sudan into states and other areas in accordance with the procedures prescribed by law. And Article 164 gives the President the power to appoint members of state assemblies during the interim period of governance. Article 165 allows the president to appoint governors of each state during the transitional period. Lawmaker Michael Makwe, who is a lawyer, says the amendments are legal.
This amendment is in accordance with the presentation which was made by the Minister of Justice in accordance with the initiative raised by His Excellency the President. This amendment is actually paving the way for the introduction of the new of the states established in accordance with the provisions of the Establishment Order number 36/2015. This amendment will give way for the establishment of the 28 states as came in the Establishment Order.
Makwe says the order of the president establishing the 28 states has now been referred to the Council of States for a vote. Opposition leader Lamakola Jawin had asked it that a constitutional court revoke the president's decision to declare 28 states, but the court has not ruled on that request.
In aggregate, thank you.
Adigo insists that today's vote was unconstitutional.
All the members of parliament, and which I showed you just now, we are 297. This is the list. I have it here. 297. We were supposed to be 332.
Adigo referred to today's decision as a jungle law of governance.
It's simply a jungle law used by the speaker by only meeting few people who are less than two-thirds, which was supposed to vote.
Minority MPs were not the only lawmakers who walked out of today's session. 37 members from the Greater Equatorial Region boycotted the sitting. MP Thomas Wanikondo explains why lawmakers refused to vote on amending the constitution.
We have passed the agreement unanimously. An agreement is now binding and is the supreme law all over the country. What we are waiting for now is for motion of the NCAC, National Committee for Amendment, National Constitutional Amendment Committee, to come out with a new amended draft constitution incorporating all the provisions of the agreement, then follow the same procedure through the Minister of Justice up to the Council of Ministers, and then table in the Parliament. Then we pass it in order to guide implementation of the agreement.
Observers with the Sout Institute and others have said the president's move to split the country into 28 states at this time is not moving the country forward toward peace. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudo in Juba.
Reuters news agency reports the UN alleges that Congolese troops in South Kivu province raped 14 women over a three-day period 2 months ago. UN Joint Human Rights Director Jose Maria Aranez says the attacks took place between September 20th and 22nd, while the troops were searching for a rebel leader in Kahele territory. Aranez calls the rapes the worst registered this year and says they are part of a pattern of violence in eastern Congo. Human rights groups have accused both government and rebel forces of using rape as a weapon of war since a dozen armed groups began operating in the region more than 15 years ago. Government spokesman Lambert Mende said he was not aware of the UN charges. He complained that the UN is maligning Congo by publicly airing the information instead of going to judicial authorities.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa. Making his first trip to the continent, the pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan's parliament today amends some provisions in the transitional constitution to give President Salva Kiir more powers to split the country into 28 states from 10. And an ambitious new initiative to end global hunger by 2025 was launched today by the International Food Policy Research Institute. Coming up, we'll have music from Mali, and in our feature segment, UN's top diplomat in Somalia says the country is well advanced in its transformation from a failed state to a recovering nation. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a French football coach tops your sports report today.
Kim, a veteran French coach who's guided the national football teams of Cameroon, Ghana, Senegal, Congo-Brazzaville, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, says he's embarking on another adventure. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma picks up the story, and he also has other football news for us.
French tactician Claude Leroy has quit as coach of the Republic of Congo, he told the media in Brazzaville. This comes a day after he guided the Congolese to a 2-1 victory over Ethiopia in Brazzaville in the second round of the Africa 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifiers. The Congolese forge ahead with a 6-4 advantage. Meanwhile, appeals against suspension of FIFA President Sepp Blatter and FIFA Vice President Michel Platini have been rejected. The FIFA Appeals Committee Chairman Larry Musenden revealed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday. Blatter and Platini were suspended from all football activities for 90 days from the 7th of October by the FIFA Independent Ethics Committee. The Ethics Committee is currently investigating a host of alleged inappropriate actions by senior FIFA officials. Blatter and Platini are at liberty to appeal their case before the Court of Arbitration in Sports. Staying in Zurich, FIFA Reforms Committee, headed by Swiss lawyer Francois Carrard, started a 2-day meeting to finalize the reform proposals today, Thursday. Once they complete their work, the proposals will be presented at the FIFA Executive Committee meeting on the 3rd of December. The FIFA Executive may amend certain provisions of the reform package before it is presented at the FIFA Special Congress, where the world's 209 national federations will be in attendance on the 26th of February next year. These reforms are key to the process of restoring FIFA's tainted image. Meanwhile, Chile's Football Association head Sergio Jadu has gone into witness protection to assist the American Federal Bureau of Investigation probing alleged corruption scandals in FIFA, media reports in the Chilean capital Santiago revealed on Wednesday. Jadu, who is also vice president of the South American Soccer Confederation, CONMEBOL, left Santiago with his family heading to New York via Miami. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thank you, Mark. Our African football guru, David Legg, is looking in alphabetical order at the 20 teams through to the final round of African qualifying for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. David says Gabon advanced by edging Mozambique in the tightest African qualifying series.
It was the only tie that went to extra time and then penalties. And the extra time was an absolute shock to me because CAF traditionally, after two matches of 90 minutes each, you go straight to penalties. But for some reason, an extra 30 minutes was played. And I think that's very unfair, Sonny. And my reason is simple. Mozambique had 90 minutes of home advantage, but Gabon had 120 minutes of home advantage. And I think that gives Gabon, in this case, an unfair advantage, and that's why I was really surprised. And so were the match commentators. They kept talking about the penalty shootout, and when extra time started, I think they were completely baffled. Anyway, there were, luckily in the sense, Sonny, no goals in extra time. The only goal, in fact, came from Aguna after just 4 minutes of the second leg. So both sides winning 1-0 at home. And then it goes to the shootout. It's 3-3 with the last kick to come. And a man whose name, I think, appears on every show of Sonny Young, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, stepped up, blasted the penalty into the net, Sonny, 4-3 on the night on the penalties, and Gabana drew, but not a particularly impressive victory. And I think at this stage, I'm not going to list Gabana as one of those likely five finalists from Africa for 2018.
David, getting back to that Bundesliga goal poacher, Aubameyang, he wasn't much of a factor in the first leg, was he?
He didn't, in fact, play, Sonny, and there was some mystery. We were officially told he had a muscular injury, but he certainly was back, and he looked rather fit for the second match. I think the Gabonese realized they had a fight on their hands. He's very much the star of this Gabonese Panthers side. There's nothing much else to recommend about them, and I know I'm sticking my neck out, Sonny, at this early stage because the third round only begins a year from now, but don't put Gabon down as one of your five finalists from Africa. I'm convinced they're not going to make it. They just didn't strike me as a side that's going to strike fear into many opponents, even with the presence of Aubameyang, who, Sonny, has scored 22 goals in 20 appearances this season in all competitions for Borussia Dortmund. Fantastic achievement. But, you know, one man can't get a team to the finals, in my opinion. So Gabon, they need to get their act together, Sonny.
Next up, David, Ghana. The Black Stars of Ghana beat the Comoros Islands 2-0 in Kumasi, and they advance on a 2-0 aggregate. Your thoughts on the Black Stars, David?
Well, the first match, Sonny, which was a goalless draw, was a great game. Fantastic atmosphere in the Comoros, a small stadium. I've seen the capacity listed as 2,000, 3,000, and 10,000. Now, clearly, there's a big problem there between the 3,000 and the 10. It certainly, Sonny, doesn't hold more than 10,000, and there wasn't a spare millimeter of space. The Comorans really turned up in force. Great game. Comoros had a goal disallowed. They hit the woodwork. Ghana hit the woodwork twice. But the return game, my feeling was, now Ghana, a bigger pitch, home advantage. They're going to teach these islanders a good lesson and maybe score three or four goals at least. But it didn't turn out that way, Sonny. Wakaso scored from a free kick after 18 minutes. But there was always that fear in the Ghanaians' heads that with the away goal rule, that if Comoros equalized, Comoros would go through. So they needed the insurance of a second goal. And that came with just 5 minutes left. It came from an Ayew, but not the normal source, Andre. It came from Jordan Ayew, the Aston Villa striker. So the Comoros can feel very proud, Sonny. They kept Ghana on tenterhooks for 175 minutes. That's how long it took Ghana to get that second goal. So not a particularly impressive performance by Ghana, who are seeking a fourth consecutive appearance at the finals. They were there in 2-6, 2-10, and 2-14, and they'll certainly be among the favourites for 2-18. But judged by the Comoros matches, they're going to have to up their game somewhat.
The Guineans beat Namibia 2-0, David, and advance on a 3-0 aggregate. Your thoughts on Guinea?
Guinea, Sonny, one of the unfortunate teams. The other are Libya, who could not play their home match at home. Unfortunately, the Ebola epidemic is still a threat to Guinea. So they had to play in Casablanca in Morocco. And a pretty predictable victory. I mean, they had already won 1-0 away to Namibia, so it was almost a fait accompli. And Silla, just before halftime, and Keita, 11 minutes from the end, scored the goals in the second leg. Guinea, at least, they're back on the victory trail. They made a very poor start to the Africa Cup of Nations, losing in Casablanca to Swaziland and then drawing in Zimbabwe. So while Namibia may not be powerhouses of African football, I think the fact that Guinea won home and away will be a tremendous morale boost for the Sili Nationale, as they're known.
Ivory Coast, the top-ranked team in Africa, advances with a 3-0 victory over Liberia in Yaoundé. The Elephants win 4-0 on aggregate. Your thoughts on the Elephants, David?
Yes, Sonny, this was another case of a team that had basically won the tie in the first leg. The Ivorians went to Monrovia. They beat Liberia 1-0. Now, for Liberia to have a realistic chance, it is they who had to build a first leg lead. Instead, the Ivorians did the trick, and then in the return match, Seo with a couple of goals in the first half, and Seri with a goal midway through the second half, a very comfortable 3-0 victory, 4-0 on aggregate. And the Ivorians will be pretty pleased, Sonny, because they were missing, for example, their injured strikers, Wilfred Bonny and Solomon Kalou, and their talismanic midfielder, Yaya Toure. has still not returned to national duty after helping them win the Cup of Nations last February. But, Sonny, the good news for Ivorian supporters and probably bad news for every other football nation in Africa is Yaya insists that he's not retiring and that he'll be back in action for the Elephants next year. So beware the Ivory Coast team with Yaya back in midfield directing operations.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And David will pick up his World Cup qualifying analysis on Friday's Sunny Side of Sports with Libya.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. In National Basketball Association news, the Houston Rockets have fired head coach Kevin McHale only 11 games into the new season. McHale, who had a Hall of Fame playing career with the Boston Celtics, got the boot Wednesday. And then a few hours later, the Rockets, under interim coach J.B. Bickerstaff, held off the visiting Portland Trailblazers 108-103 in overtime. Elsewhere, the Philadelphia 76ers and defending champion Golden State Warriors continue to be two NBA clubs heading in opposite directions. Philadelphia was humbled by the Indiana Pacers Wednesday night, 112-85. Winless Philadelphia has lost its first 12 games to start the season. Meanwhile, the unbeaten and red-hot Warriors go after their 13th consecutive victory later Thursday night when they visit Los Angeles and play another California club, the Los Angeles Clippers. Golden State has been led by sharpshooting guard Stephen Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player, who is averaging almost 34 points per game. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, UN's top diplomat in Somalia says the country is well advanced in its transformation from a failed state to a recovering nation. And next, hundreds of delegates from across Africa and around the world meet in Cape Town, South Africa, to discuss youth and employment. But first, some music. It is Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo Yambo.
Yambo, 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 y
Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo Yambo.
Well, just days before Somalia opened its embassy in Washington, D.C. for the first time in 24 years, the U.N.'s top diplomat in Somalia, Nicholas Kay, says the country is well advanced in its transformation from a failed state to a recovering nation. Kay recently told the U.N. Security Council that 2016 will be a decisive year for Somalia on several fronts. From the U.N., VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
In his final briefing to the council after more than 2 years as the UN's envoy in Somalia, Kay said the country is moving away from the chaos that defined it for more than two decades.
At last, Somalia is facing the problems of a country coming together rather than falling apart.
Kay noted work on organizing the country's numerous regions into states is slowly progressing and urged a swift conclusion to that process. Next year's elections will also be an important benchmark. Kay said they must be conducted on time and be more inclusive than 2012's vote. The envoy also noted that no major commercial ship has been seized by pirates off Somalia's coast for more than 3 years. One ongoing spoiler to Somalia's recovery is the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, which continues to attack government and civilian targets, carrying out a deadly bombing on a well-known hotel just over a week ago. Meanwhile, the road for Somalia's recovery is long. Some 3.2 million people still need assistance to survive, and the UN is warning that projected flooding and drought could make the situation worse. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Hundreds of delegates from across Africa and around the world recently met in Cape Town, South Africa, to discuss youth unemployment and potential opportunities for them in agriculture. The summit, dubbed Young Africa Works, was hosted by the MasterCard Foundation. The youth summit attracted senior government officials, business executives, the private sector, civil society, and international donors. From Cape Town, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
The summit focused on best practices and effective approaches for preparing young people for employment and entrepreneurship opportunities in agriculture. It also encouraged young participants to explore the challenges they face in securing meaningful economic opportunities. Ms. Thelma Namonje, a 30-year-old research associate from the Zambia-based Indaba Agricultural Policy Research Institute, was among those who took part in the summit. She says she believes that this generation can end the global food insecurity if practical strategies and solutions are developed to enable young people in Africa embrace sustainable agriculture.
It's something that the continent has faced for a long time, food insecurity every time. It's a song that we've been singing. And it's time that the young generation take up that as their responsibility to do something. If they can actively engage in agriculture, they don't necessarily have to be involved in digging, but there are a number of value chains in agriculture where the youths can play a key role. And I think it's time we did that.
Speaking to the Voice of America at the close of the summit, Rita Roy, President and Chief Executive Officer of the MasterCard Foundation, said the conference helped to stimulate unique fresh thinking around ways in which young people can make the transition into employment, especially into agricultural sector.
I think the first thing that has come out of the conference is high energy. That's what I've heard, because we put young people at the center of the work at the summit. And so we saw some very demonstrable examples of how young people are already taking action. We heard from a young entrepreneur who began at the Africa Rabbit Center when she was 14 years old. And we learned that each female rabbit can generate revenue of $1,000 a year.
A recent study conducted over the past 6 months revealed that some 600 million people in Africa are under the age of 25, and 72% of its youth live on less than $2 a day. The findings highlight the extraordinary length that young people go to as they try to find work. Namonje says the lack of access to credit facilities among the youth is a major deterrent.
Most youths don't have capital. You go to a bank, they need collateral. You're only 18 or 20, and you haven't accumulated any assets to use to go and borrow funds and all that. If you can have microfinancing institutions that can help the young people to start up a business, that would be very helpful.
Regarding the foundation's work in Africa, Roy said the Toronto-based organization is working in 28 countries across the continent, where it has committed $1.6 billion. She says its programs are concentrated in three areas.
One is to expand access to financial services for people who are living in poverty. Second is to expand access to education, especially the secondary level and at the higher education level. And third is to bring what we know from financial services and education to really focus on enabling young people who never had the chance to go to school to be able to transition from unemployment or maybe hazardous work to decent work so they can have sustainable livelihoods.
She said the first agricultural sector is critical to the transformation of the continent, both economically and socially.
I just came away from one of the sessions with an organization called Harambe, which is right here in South Africa, very unique model, which is all about understanding where is their demand in the economy. And they showed a very, very in-depth analysis of how they could map 680,000 jobs here in South Africa across the agricultural sector. And the vast majority of those jobs are for students or young people who don't even need a basic metric degree. So what it's revealing to us is there is opportunity. Opportunity which we may not even see right now, but it's here.
Some of the key topics discussed included agriculture in Africa and its growth prospects, agricultural financial services, and the role of technology. Among the youth speakers at the conference was Hawad Milasi, Country Project Manager for the Opportunities for Youth Employment Program in Tanzania. It's a local youth development initiative supported by the Netherlands NGO SNV in partnership with the Mastercard Foundation.
Speaking of my country, we have about 100,000 young people who are coming out of universities every year. But the labor market cannot take up all these youth. So an option is entrepreneurship. And if I very much try to look at agriculture, it's something that is quite broad. But how can we bring about innovation? How can we train our youth to be entrepreneurial? How can we expose them to such opportunities so that agriculture can be a meaningful employer for them?
According to experts, the agricultural sector is said to create 8 million stable jobs by the year 2020 and up to 14 million if governments and entrepreneurs can boost investment. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to six key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Obeida Diriye, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, Hassan Afguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Malim Salman and Ahmad Iman Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate Shopping Mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Obeida, also known as Diriye, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi O. Mohammed, otherwise known as Godanye. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations and the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmad Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice Office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.